Welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Mary Kay Magstead, Associate Director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations and a former China correspondent for NPR and for PRX's The World. The U.S.-China relationship has always been interesting, in different ways over time. Now, China under Xi Jinping has global ambitions that challenge U.S. interests and domestic realities, like a slowing economy and shrinking workforce, that challenge China's leadership at home. Understanding China in all its complexity and contradictions takes time. And today's guest, Orville Schell, has put in that time, about six decades worth. Orville is founder and director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. He's also a respected journalist, author, and scholar focusing on China, who I've known and appreciated over decades. We sat down to talk in his Berkeley home in California, starting out by looking at photos of him in a changing China over the years.
Oh, this is Fang Lijie and his wife, Li Shushan. And Perry Link and us out of the Ming tombs, about 87, maybe. Everything seemed possible. Let's see what else I can find here. Oh, here's
Liu Xiaobo
and Baifeng and I in 1989 in the square. And here's me and Fang Lijie at Cambridge when he escaped, finally got out of the embassy. We flew to London to meet him. He's Deng Xiaoping's son.
Deng
Fufeng. Deng Fufeng at our ranch. He came out for a visit back in the day. Me and the Dalai Lama. And Chiang Kai-gu and his then wife. Anyway, it goes on. Oh, let me pour some tea before we get into it here.
Oh, lemongrass.
It's verbena.
Oh.
We have a tree out here.
Nice.
Yep.
Cheers. So, you first got interested in China in 1960?
No, it was before that. I first got interested when I was at college because I wanted to take a class with my sister who was there. And the only one that fit our schedule was this famous class called Rice Paddies, which John Fairbank and Edwin Reischauer taught on China and Japan. And I had no idea what I was stumbling into. It turned out it met every day, which is unusual for a course, and had a voluminous amounts of reading. And by the time I got to the end of it, I had been studying in the Harvard Yenching Library and, you know, seeing all the books and Korean, Japanese, Chinese, and kind of wondering what that was all about. So I decided, since I didn't really know what else to do with myself, that I would drop out and go off to Taiwan, which is the only place you could go, or Hong Kong, to study Chinese. So I did that. And I worked on a Norwegian freighter, left from San Francisco here. And on my way out there, I had an errant uncle in Tahiti, which caused my parents a good deal of consternation that I might end up a beachcomber in Tahiti. And I stopped off and saw him for a few days and then slowly made my way further west and paid off that ship in New Guinea and spent a month there wandering around trying to find another ship to go north. And finally I got to Taiwan and I started Chinese.
So what year was that?
That must have been 1960, 61 in there someplace.
What was Taiwan like then?
Taiwan had no high-rise buildings. It was like dog patch. It was really backward and very, you know, the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek, hadn't been there for hardly 10 years. And it was very, very primitive. And I was at Taiwan University living in a dormitory and had seven roommates, you know, stacked up like cordwood in this dormitory.
Well, it's a very Chinese experience.
Very Chinese experience. And it was a good experience. It plunged me right into the heart of it.
And what did you know at that point, and what did your fellow students know in Taiwan about what was happening in China then?
Well, I mean, we knew something. I knew something because having taken that course and I took some other courses as well. That was sort of the glory days of Harvard's China studies. You know, Benjamin Schwartz and Rod McFarquhar, all these people were there circling around. I mean, people like Perry Link and Andy Nathan were grad students. And so there was a lot of really interesting activity. Of course, no one could go to China. I was utterly fascinated with China itself, but couldn't get there. That, in large measure, fueled my own interest in it. It was sort of an unattainable goal. It was a bit like Lhasa for explorers, you know. They all wanted to just get there. But try as I did, and I used to go off in the summertime around Southeast Asia and go to Chinese embassies in Cambodia and Laos, and but it was nothing to be done. You couldn't go. But we used to sit on the beach in Taiwan and go out in the nighttime and camp on a beautiful beach near Geelong and listen on transistor radios to the broadcast coming in from China. And, you know, just trying to imagine what it was like.
Do you remember what they would say in the broadcast?
It was sort of like the socialist education campaign, and it was just beginning to sort of wind up a little bit. You know, Mao had been out and was coming back, but no one quite knew what was happening.
So when you started studying, did you have any sense of the fact that there was a famine in China?
Very little sense. And of course, sort of the common wisdom was that at that point, Taiwan itself was something of an autocracy with Chiang Kai-shek and martial law. And even though they had very good intelligence and they did know about the famine and they did broadcast it and publish it, many of us thought, well, you know, who do we believe? And so we were a little bit skeptical. But it turned out that they did have it nailed to rights.
So at that point, we're talking 61, early 60s, Mao Zedong had been in power for a dozen years. There'd already been the Great Leap Forward. As a young student of Chinese, what was your sense of who Mao was and what he was doing in China?
Well, you know, I think my generation was very, very influenced by Edgar Snow, who actually was a friend of John Fairbanks. And I remember he came and spoke at this class.
And he's, of course, the American journalist who went to visit Mao and everyone else before they came to power.
Yes, Edgar Snow was the reporter who went to Yan'an and wrote, which is still, in many ways, the definitive biography of Mao, and got in chapter and verse, I think, the most detailed version from Mao himself about his youth, his family life and growing up, and his sort of psychological disposition. But Edgar Snow was somewhat sympathetic to the Maoist revolution, both because he'd come into it in an earlier and milder form when in Yan'an in the 40s. But my attitude towards it was, I was very curious. I really didn't know what to think. That's why I wanted to go there. I wanted to see if it was functional, and whether it was working or not. And I could see in Taiwan what their form of authoritarian government was, and I was not too supportive of that. But we used to go down to the presidential palace, and Chiang Kai-shek would have tea parties for the foreign students. There were only about 12 of us, 10 or 12 of us there at the time. And that was sort of interesting. I used to ride my bike down to the presidential palace and then put my tie on and go in and...
Huh. So what was it about Taiwan's form of authoritarianism that you didn't like? Just the fact that it was authoritarianism, or was there something specific that you...
Well, it turned out it was nowhere near as brutal as what the communists had effected on the mainland, but it was still a one-party system, and people were in jail, and they had prisons out on islands where people got sent, and wasn't freedom of expression, freedom of press, or any of these things. And there was a lot of criticism of them for that. And I think in a certain sense, it was somewhat unnecessary, as we learned later when his son, Zhang Jinghuo, just then ended martial law and really allowed Taiwan to bloom forth as a fully fledged democratic system.
So fast forward 14 years from when you first pitched up in Taiwan, that was your first trip into China, and it was the tail end of the Cultural Revolution. What was that like?
Well, I got invited to go on a trip that had been approved by Zhou Enlai as part of his, I mean, he was part of that contingent of leaders who believed that China did need to open up somewhat and did need to be more practical and less political. And he was, in a certain sense, a counterforce to Chairman Mao. He early on had proposed the four modernizations. And of course, that would be to modernize China, you know, technologically, scientifically, myriad other ways. And that did involve some quotient of opening to the outside world. So he had allowed a few trips to come in, organized by a fellow traveler, Bill Hinton, who had been in China since the 1940s when he was there in the United Nations Relief Administration. And I got included, even though I was writing for The New Yorker at the time, because I had known some of the family members. And that was a real wake-up call for me because, of course, I was very excited to go. But I thought that I had some fundamental notion about how to interact with Chinese, and I spoke some Chinese, and yet when I got to China, it was utterly insoluble. And then when they found out I was writing for The New Yorker, the door slammed down and they became very nervous. And at one point, when I was working in Dajai, the model agricultural brigade, they put me in my cave and didn't let me out for several days, you know, told me I was sick, that I needed to stay there and get well. But really what was going on was that they knew that I was a writer and they didn't quite know how to deal with that. And here I was on this fraternal Qingyan Laodongtuan, a youth work brigade. And we were allegedly working, of course, just basically impeding progress. But that was not what they had in mind, was someone who was going to be writing about the experience. And I found myself again and again, you know, if I would wander off to another village to talk to people, they'd come and get me. I remember one time I met this wonderful man, clearly a very sophisticated, educated man who was a doctor, and he was taking care of fruit trees at the brigade. And I said, well, I'd love to come and just see what you do. And he said, okay. And when the authorities found out that he and I had connected directly, they immediately turned on him and criticized him, and that's when I got locked up. So it was a real wake-up call for me. And I didn't quite know what was going on, but I knew something wasn't right.
What kind of work did they have you do?
You know, we were spreading compost, hauling manure, cultivating orchards. I mean, it was basically nonsense. I mean, you know, we weren't actually doing anything. We were just going through the Potemkin, creating a simulacrum of work. And then in the Shanghai Electrical Machinery Factory, where I worked for a month, I would sit there in front of a giant DC generator winding wire. But I mean, I was no help in terms of aiding the progress of the Chinese communist development.
So this was the final year of the Cultural Revolution, 75, 76.
Yeah, yeah.
What were people saying to you about what was going on? I mean, both the official version, I assume there were some sessions where officials explained to your group what they had been building in China.
You know, we got plunged into criticism sessions, study sessions, to criticize Lin Biao and criticize Confucius. And of course, Lin Biao was Mao's designated successor and head of the People's Liberation Army and a very weird, twisted man.
And Lin Biao had gone down in a plane under suspicious circumstances with some suspicion that he had been involved in
a coup.
Right.
He was clear. He had had some, you know, activity against Mao, and there were all sorts of notions about his conspiracy. But, of course, Confucius was considered to be a stand-in for Premier Zhou Enlai, who was a kind of a mandarin, a cosmopolitan man. And some say a facilitator, others say tempered Mao's revolution, and I think both is true.
So you were going to big gatherings where these two were being criticized?
Well, we would have our own gatherings with some Chinese facilitators where we'd read these documents. And of course, there were many people on my trip who were very naive and knew nothing about China and were quite leftist to boot. And so there's a lot of pressure to conform to whatever the views were that the Chinese held. And it was very important and interesting for me to participate in that and to understand what that's like. that when the prevailing wind gets blowing, you can oppose it, but you're going to end up getting locked in your cave. And at one point, I thought I'd get sent home. So it was a kind of a very light version of what I think Chinese experience. Very censorious, very intimidating, and you realize that you do not oppose the prevailing ideology.
So when you went home from that visit, did it change how you thought about how you were going to be engaging with China from that point on?
Yes, and as I was writing, I wrote this, I think it was a 5-part series for The New Yorker, and I think it was rather superficial in retrospect because there was so little you could actually know, and you never really got to talk to anybody. You only got what they would present to you. And we had these endless, what they called, brief introductions, head-bangingly boring about how many jin of Galiang were produced and how many mu of land and on and on and on.
They still do that.
But there was not any opportunity to really roam around. And insofar as I did roam around, I invariably got in trouble. And, you know, you go out early in the morning and before you'd rambled more than 5 minutes, you'd have 100 people traipsing along behind you, and then the police would come, and then your minders would come, and, you know, all hell would break loose. This was not a society that was used to foreigners, was not used to spontaneous interaction, and did not want you connecting in any way with anybody that wasn't scripted.
Did you have any spontaneous interactions with Chinese while you were there?
Very few. We worked with some kids, but they couldn't tell you much. No, I mean, it was very ritualized and very frustrating because, I mean, I thought I understood how to interact. And here, everywhere you turned, you were thwarted.
So at the time, I mean, you'd invested years in learning Chinese. You'd come on this visit. Were you thinking, I have to reconsider my focus on China? Or, I mean, it doesn't sound like it was the kind of experience that would make you feel like, I want to keep engaging here.
Well, it was a very bewildering experience in many ways. Then, of course, it wasn't so many years after that, 79, 80, it began to open up. And then I went back literally hundreds of times. Then I continued writing for The New Yorker as this amazing process unfolded, trying to make sense out of it. Where was it going? How did the Cultural Revolution generate Deng Xiaoping and his reforms? And then I began to really connect with people. And I remember in, I guess it was 78 or 79, I met this young woman who subsequently became a very good friend on the street out in front of the Pakistani embassy. And we started walking, and we walked for like 6 hours all over the city, and I took her whole story down. What was so interesting about her is that she announced back then she wanted to be a fashion designer. I thought, holy Toledo. And she told me her whole story, and I subsequently wrote it up and published it in Rolling Stone. And the head of the Fashion Institute of Technology called me up and said, if she ever gets out, we'll take her. So when she came out, I introduced them, and she went to the Fashion Institute of Technology and did become a designer. And that only could happen, of course, after Deng Xiaoping came into power and people started opening up and feeling free to consort with foreigners.
Let me take a break here to let you know you can find some of the photos Orville and I went through at the beginning of this episode, along with the print version of this conversation, in the December 2021 issue of Asia Society magazine. This award-winning magazine features contributions from writers, artists, photographers, activists, and subject experts from Asia and around the world. Check it out at asiasociety.org/magazine. Now, back to my conversation with Orville. We're at something of a moment now when maybe someone who was a young version of you, who was like 20 or 21 and had studied Chinese and is looking at what's happening in China now, might feel like, I wonder how much room there is to do what I had hoped I would do in this field. What would you say to that person?
Well, I'd say it's not quite certain that we're going to close down to the same degree, but we're getting very close, where we may have to appreciate this country sort of remotely and via distance through filters and interpretation of documents, of photographs, of programs, where the primary mode of interacting is not interpersonally, you know, where you don't have friends or friends are reserved. I think friends still will talk now when you're in private, but we don't know what's to come. And if there were some kind of clash or something that could really sort of harden the state of adversity between the two countries, things could very easily shift back. I mean, I think for me, what's so interesting, and I remember thinking this at the time, that when Deng Xiaoping came in 78 and 79 and sort of waved his wand and seemed to cancel the past, I remember thinking, not so fast, that you don't go through 10, 20 years of tectonic class struggle and revolution and just wave it away. It gets into your DNA somehow, and it will re-express itself in some way going forward. And I think that's exactly what's happening now.
It's what's happening now. How did you see that happening in any way in the 80s, which otherwise were considered to be a pretty open time in China?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was painfully aware in the 80s, even though it was an immensely exciting time and where things were really open in a way that I never could have foreseen in 1975, that within that reform movement, there was a steel shank of one-party rule that never was dissolved. And you know, Deng Xiaoping himself in the early 80s reminded everybody. He had what he called the Sige Gunban Yuanzi, the four basic principles. And nobody paid much attention to them. They were so excited by the reforms. But basically what it said is the party is the center and everything grows out of the party. And don't forget it. So even as he was catalyzing all of these centrifugal tendencies and reforms and marketization and intellectual openness and elections even and all of these things, that basic core operating system never changed.
Didn't he at some point say that China could potentially become a democracy in 50 years?
He and other people during that period flirted with that idea. But there was never any sense that they were going to promote that idea. But the presumption was that if things just kept changing, and they were changing so rapidly, it was very hard to imagine them stopping after a while, that ultimately they would draw nearer and nearer to a more sort of convergent state with the Western outside world, democratic world. I think nobody was fooled that China, like Athena springing out of the head of Zeus, would become a Jeffersonian democracy. But I think everybody thought the tendency, the trend is good. Keep it going. But if you look carefully, you know, the structure didn't change a bit. It was a sort of a surface reform that didn't alter the basic Stalinist structure that underlay it.
But in the 80s, I didn't spend time there much except in 89, but you did. I hear people talk about how robust the conversations were, that there were salons at universities, that it really felt like political reform was possible, in addition to the economic reform that was happening in the countryside and helping farmers lift themselves out of poverty.
It was extraordinary what happened in the 80s. And, you know, people could basically publish almost anything. All kinds of Western works were being translated. Television programs, history programs, some of them were very exciting and innovative and interesting. There was an intellectual yeastiness that matched the sort of marketization of the economy. And there was even, you know, elections, village elections for party chiefs. And they even had elections that went up into the prefects and up into the next sort of level of governance, even in cities like Beijing. And then you had figures like Fang Lijie, the great astrophysicist, who in 86 and 87 went abroad and started writing about his experiences abroad and then went across China on an incredible tear, speaking at every major university in the most intelligent but provocative way, saying that China needed to get rid of its one-party system and become a democracy, to become a truly modern society. And of course, they kicked him out of the party. But they didn't do anything more than that. And I remember he was a very good friend, and we saw him all the time, my wife and I, who was Chinese. And I remember once when Tom Brokaw was there with the whole network of NBC, and he had interviewed Zhao Ziyang. So we invited Fang Lijie to come to the studio where NBC was doing all of their satellite broadcasting to look at the tape of Zhao Ziyang talking about him, and where Zhao Ziyang said, well, they only kicked him out of the party because he really wasn't a good party member. But they weren't going to do anything else to him for speaking out. It was quite reasonable, but it was very stunning to see a premier and then party general secretary speak of a dissident in such a temperate way while the dissident was watching him on the screen.
Yeah. So the Tiananmen protests came out of this era. Did it surprise you that so many people took to the streets?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. There were other earlier demonstrations, and that's why Hu Yaobang fell, the party general secretary, and Zhao Ziyang came in 86, 87. There were some student demonstrations, but not on the same scale. It did surprise me because, yes, you could feel there was some disaffection and there was inflation and a few things and corruption, but once that snowball got rolling, it was very hard to stop. Everybody sort of piled on, and given the sort of permissive environment that the party had allowed up to then, made people feel that the costs of participating would not be high. And then you started to get party pushback, and then we know what happened in the end. It got very, very dark and very, very brutal. But it was a period, again, of amazing optimism and openness in the sense that maybe history actually was going to change and the party actually would relent or reform and allow a more tolerant society to evolve.
And you were there in the protests.
I was there for, I don't know how many weeks. Very interestingly, in April, we were having a conference out here in California, in Bolinas, with about 30 Chinese intellectuals and American scholars on exactly the topic of what was the intelligentsia thinking and where was it all going to go. And, you know, there are all kinds of people like Chiang Kai-ge and Liu Bingyan and Wu Zhuguang, people like that who were very notable intellectual figures at the time. And then the demonstrations erupted with the death of Hu Yaobang, and we had people like Fang Lijie phoning in from Beijing at night to tell us what was going on. And then after this conference ended, we all jumped on planes and went back.
Where were you the night of June 3rd?
I had left China by the night of June 3rd. Yeah, I was not there at that time.
So did that surprise you?
Well, of course it was shocking. It was literally unbelievable that that would happen. On the other hand, power grows out of the barrel of a gun, and the party has the gun. So in a certain sense, it seemed almost fatally destined that it couldn't end any other way. But it was still, at least during the early phases of the demonstrations, which lasted for almost 7 weeks, it was hard to believe that that would be the end.
So I first met you and interviewed you, I guess it was 3 years after that. So a lot of people who had taken part in the protests or who had supported them, you know, kind of accepted, okay, we're in this new era where what we thought might be possible probably isn't, but at least we can make money. And I remember at the time you were, it was right after Deng Xiaoping had done his Southern tour and he was talking about, yes, make money. I mean, this is a good thing. And you seemed a bit pessimistic about where China was going then. As you were able to go back into China from time to time, I mean, you put together, co-edited the Tiananmen papers. So I think for a while you had some issues getting into China.
Oh, yeah, I've always had a few issues.
Yeah, I mean, what did you make of what you were seeing over those next couple of decades, the 90s and the 2000s, where it was an increasingly prosperous and increasingly powerful China? You wrote the book Wealth and Power, co-wrote the book with John Delury. What was it saying to you that this was happening alongside the fact that the Tiananmen crackdown had happened?
Well, I thought that China was engaged in an amazing experiment, and I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. Basically, the covenant was you can become wealthy and have a better life, just keep your nose clean politically. And I wasn't sure that was going to work, because having seen the wellspring of sentiment that had erupted in the 80s, and particularly in 1989, it seemed unlikely that they could stamp that down. Now, I think they actually were quite successful, and they gave him, an off-ramp, which was economic prosperity. But, you know, I've learned, I think, over the years that China is a very sort of bipolar proposition, and it has within it these sort of opposite tendencies that wax and wane, and at any moment it looks like only one side is there, but the other side is incipient. And if you had said to me in 1975 when I was there working, oh, listen, in 2-3 years you're going to find something absolutely different going on, I would have thought you were mad. There was not a whiff of it. So I think even now, where the marketization has come to a kind of a curious moment, and freedom of expression and dissenting views are largely suppressed, it doesn't mean that that ability, that tendency, is completely erased from the sort of historical genome and won't come out again sometime.
Yeah. You kind of wrapped all of this in your novel, which recently came out, My Old Home, which you worked on over the course of 30 years. What made you decide? You've written, 10, 12 books on China?
I can't remember.
A lot of books on China, a lot of articles. What made you decide that there were things you wanted to say in a novel that you perhaps couldn't get to as easily in some of your other writing?
You know, one of the things I think that Chinese have never done particularly well, and the literary tradition, philosophical tradition, doesn't lend itself to this, and that is to a certain kind of sort of almost psychoanalytical introspection. In other words, what motivates people psychologically as well as politically, economically, culturally. And I felt that the more I wrestled around with trying to understand and explain China, the more I felt there were some powerful forces that were really driving society and its leaders, and that you couldn't explain them purely by nonfiction and policy. So that's what sent me off on an effort to look at it with a different lens, namely through fiction. And I thought maybe if I could get at things like religion, people's interpersonal relations, culture, music, literature, all of these things which bespeak of a different side of sort of the human condition, I could come to some more fulsome depiction of what I had come to see as animating China. And as I say, these sort of oscillating but very extreme pulses sometimes of one thing and then another thing. But that doesn't mean when you're in one phase that the other tendency is completely extirpated.
So then that would suggest that even as we're in the phase that we're in now, that going forward, other things may emerge.
This is no more China now than the China of Mao Zedong that I encountered and was so bewildered by in 1975. It's one aspect of a personality that has learned how to sort of live in a suppressed universe where you can only express certain parts of yourself.
So you have, for 15 years, headed the Center on U.S.-China Relations. You founded it. One thing we haven't talked about yet is how all of this relates to China's relationship with the United States. And that has had its swings from one direction to another as well. What do you make of how we got where we are at the moment?
Well, you know, just as China has been through very different totalistic phases, shut down and opening up of suppression and a more freer environment, so too it's been through some very extreme versions of the love, hate, attraction, repulsion mechanism with the U.S. And I think both are profoundly deep in China. I think there is a tremendous fascination with America and an affection for America that goes back more than a century. And yet there's also a deep and abiding uneasiness about being too slavishly admiring or under the shadow of America. And, you know, that expression in Chinese, that the American moon is rounder than the Chinese moon. I mean, that really rankles Chinese, and it sends them in extreme directions. They admire America, I think many of them, and respect it, but they do not want to live under the dictatorship of someone else's way of doing things.
So I covered China on both sides of the turn of the century, and so heard quite often that, you know, if the 20th century was America's, the 21st would be China's. And the Belt and Road Initiative, which is often lauded as the most ambitious, biggest global infrastructure initiative ever, is one vehicle through which the Chinese government hopes to attain this status. What do you make of the chances of this happening, that China surpasses the U.S. as the premier global superpower?
Well, you have to take your hats off to the Chinese Communist Party. You know, to put it in President Bush the Latter parlance, they've done a heck of a job. I mean, they have brought about an amazing rejuvenation of China, and they've proved much more durable than anybody thought they would. So that's an incontrovertible fact, and the Belt and Road is kind of a manifestation of this very bold idea to restore China to a state of global greatness that it imagines it, and in fact did in certain ways have in days gone by. But within that system that they have used to accomplish so much, it also seems to me there are many, many contradictions. Perhaps the most vexing for me, you know, it's the contradiction against some fundamental human instincts. I mean, if you believe, as I do, that people by and large would rather be as free as they can within the social compact or whatever world they have to live, then what Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party are doing is in many sense a violation of some fundamental human impulses.
So you think they kind of have a blind spot in terms of recognizing what people around the world actually want and how much that's going to matter in terms of whether they can really be the kind of power they want to be?
I mean, maybe in the good old days when the divine right of kings was still extant in Europe and America wasn't around yet and there was no democratic world. Okay, good autocracy, you just join the club. But now it seems to me history has really moved to a different stage. And I think that their form of autocratic rule has a certain logic, and I think maybe some of it should be maintained in a country as big and difficult to govern as China. But an awful lot of it is excessive, and it seems to me tremendously counterproductive and not in the interest of a ruling party. You know, why piss everybody off unnecessarily, either within your country by being too strict, too repressive, or abroad by having too much wolf warrior diplomacy just because you can throw your weight around. I think this is where there's a profound structural weakness in what the party is doing.
So in this moment, what do you think is a robust way that the United States can engage with China, deal with China, counter China in the world? What's the right balance?
Well, I think that in a certain sense, the best remedy is to be strong ourselves in every way, militarily, culturally, technologically, economically, you name it. The second thing is to weave together as tight a fabric of allies, partners, and friends who share sort of common principles and forms of governance, you know, the so-called rules-based world order. But at the same time, to keep the door as wide open as possible to China, not try to change the way they live or govern themselves, but also don't participate if it's not in our interest. But you can't do it alone. China loves to deal with people bilaterally and pick them off and kneecap them. You have to be together. We did that in NATO, and I don't know whether we'll do it. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is sort of possibly coalescing now, but we'll see. But then to try to recognize there are areas where we really should cooperate, and if we're going to lead, we have to lead. To lead, you have to take chances, and you have to always make it clear that there is a way that we could foresee collaborating and cooperating.
So last question, I mean, let's come down from 30,000 feet to a more personal take on Chinese culture and China itself, since you've spent so much of your life there and intertwined with many things related to China. When you were writing your novel and you said you wanted to kind of get to the essence of some of these aspects of Chinese culture that really were meaningful to you, that, you know, maybe didn't come up as much when you're writing about policy, what is it that you think is important for Americans in particular to understand?
Well, you know, the amazing thing for me is that there are some things that have come out of the Chinese Communist Revolution that I'm sort of amazed by it. I mean, there are certain qualities in many Chinese that I know, friends, and I certainly experienced it in my marriage, that are really extraordinary and esteemable. The real problem is different forms of governance and different state-sponsored values. And I just frankly do not believe that governments need to be bullies, that they need to push people around and lock people up. And yes, it's messy to be democratic. All right, don't be completely democratic, but be a little more democratic. That's the best way to be. So what I've learned, I guess, is that China always lurches to extremes. I saw it in 1975. The Cultural Revolution was an extreme. And I believe Xi Jinping is an extreme. They went through a period in the 1980s when marketization was an extreme. They did a crackdown after 89, which is an extreme. This is their specialty. And China's challenge is to find some middle path. This was Confucius's challenge. And that's exactly what China has not been able to find under the Chinese Communist Party, a kind of a more temperate balance point in the middle that maybe is somewhat messier, but is perhaps more durable.
Orville Schell, thank you.
Pleasure.
That's Orville Schell, Arthur Ross Director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. Thanks for listening to our conversation. You can check out other episodes of Asia in Depth and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And you can find more detail about all our episodes at asiasociety.org/podcasts. Asia Society is a nonprofit organization that works to increase understanding between Asia and the West through research, programming, and initiatives on arts, education, policy, and business. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society, and keep listening to Asia in Depth.